Welcome to the Bulwark Podcast Friday. What the heck is happening today? I'm sorry, it's been this week. It feels like this week has been a through the looking glass moment, which seems like it's understating it. You know, the president with his bizarre rants, the tweets about being the king of Israel and the second coming of God and how you can solve veteran suicides with some sort of where do you start with all of this? And now, even though we had figured we were going to talk about a variety of things, the president is now tweeting. By now, everybody knows this, but I'm just sitting here looking at a series of tweets from the president of the United States. My only question is, who is our bigger enemy, Jay Powell or Chairman Xi? Next one. Our country has lost stupidly trillions of dollars with China over many years. They have stolen our intellectual property at a rate of hundreds of billions of dollars a year. And they want to continue. I won't let that happen! Exclamation point. We don't need China, and frankly, would be far. Next tweet. Better off without them. The vast amounts of money made and stolen by China from the United States year after year for decades will and must stop. All in caps. And okay, here it goes. Our great American companies are hereby ordered to immediately start looking for an alternative to China, including bringing, next tweet, your company's home, all in caps, and making your products in the USA. I will be responding to China's tariffs this afternoon. This is a great, all in caps, opportunity for the United States. Also, I am ordering all carriers, including FedEx, Amazon, UPS, and the post office to, this is all in caps, search for and refuse, next tweet, all deliveries of fentanyl from China or anywhere else, exclamation point, fentanyl kills, goes on. So, okay, so we have the President of the United States, Sarah, hereby ordering American companies to immediately start looking for an alternative to China. What is happening, please? What? Help. What?
Why doesn't somebody take his phone? Like, doesn't he have somebody? Because this is long. Like, I think this qualifies as a thread.
A thread.
He's like tweeting us into a recession. And I just don't understand. Like, this is what it's come to. It's come to wishing that somebody would go into whatever room he's in, watching the news, and that they would physically take his phone out of his hand. Because right now, the Dow is in real time plunging because of these tweets.
Okay, I'm going to regret saying this because it feels like this is the week that Donald Trump broke. Somebody tweeted out, this is the day that, China, broke for President Trump. It just feels like complete panic. It feels unhinged. It's in public. And it's immensely consequential because, of course, the question was, are we going to go into a trade war? Will it escalate? How will the president respond to all of the indicators that perhaps the economy might go wobbly? This has become the big story, right? China pounces today, and I think because they're seeing a little bit of the flop sweat coming from the president, seeing some of the weakness, and therefore sensing an opening, they respond by slapping tariffs on $75 billion in goods. And the president has freaking meltdown, on Twitter in real time. So, Andrew Egger, what are we seeing here?
I mean, these stories are always so sort of interesting because on the one hand, you read tweets like this and you sort of go bug-eyed and you're like, I cannot believe these words that I'm reading right now. I can't believe the president of the United States is unironically, ordering around U.S. companies. Essentially, he orders not only, all U.S. companies to get ready to stop doing business with China, our largest trading partner, but also orders all mail carriers, both the U.S. Postal Service, the public one, and all the private ones to apparently just begin, searching all packages coming into the country on the chance they might contain fentanyl, which they could then, refuse delivery for. So it's really, really wild stuff. But then, on the other hand, it's completely to be expected that something like this would occur because this death spiral that we're in with the trade war now, it sort of forces these situations because what's happened is that China has pledged that they are not going to back down from this confrontation. They're saying they're going to go tit for tat with Donald Trump on all of these tariffs. And every time there's a new round, it's as though Trump can't even believe that they're following through on that on that commitment. And he seems to think they're bluffing. He seems to think, oh, if I just slap another round on, that will be the one that finally, you know, breaks their spirit and makes them, you know, capitulate to all of my nebulous demands on all of these different issues. But then when they don't, he sort of goes ballistic for a bit. And then he thinks to himself, well, okay, so clearly that wasn't enough. So I guess we need to do more tariffs now. And there is no exit to this cycle except for either China or Trump to finally throw up their hands and say, okay, you know what, this has gotten
okay,
too stupid.
But you're leaving out a key element here, I think. Everything you said is true, but I think there's a key variable here, which is the pure crazy of this. Okay, the president, can we just clarify this? The president said, "You are hereby, American companies are hereby ordered to."
Isn't that seizing the means of production? Isn't that like the actual definition of seizing the means of production?
It does sound awfully like that. And I guess the question is, could we at least acknowledge that the president is trying to exercise authority that he does not have legally? Or are we about to find out in the next 24 hours? Yes, by the way, because, you know, Congress gave the executive branch this power, you know, when they were, you know, headed out to, you know, holiday one when you're that the president can order American companies to leave a foreign country. I mean, does the president, is there any legal basis for this? Are we supposed to?
Well, I mean, so the theory would be, I mean, that it would be essentially an executive trade embargo, right? And I mean, like the president has the ability to do, you know, thing. I mean, I'm certainly no trade expert, but he has the ability to do, you know, things around the edges of that, especially when it comes to national security concerns and things like that. And
can
what we've seen from the White
American,
House.
Can he order? Is there any legal base? Are we supposed to take this literally, seriously, figuratively? What is this just? I mean, you are hereby ordered. What does that mean?
Well, what I was just going to say is that we've seen from the White House before that they have no, you know, qualms about sort of shoehorning any particular move they want to do into whatever language, you know, they want to, you know, whatever language gives them the legal authority to do whatever they want to do, even if the actual trade action has nothing to do with whatever that statute was for. So, for example, the idea that we needed to slap steel and aluminum tariffs on China because of the national security concern of, you know, propping up our domestic steel and aluminum industries in case of war, that sort of thing. So I don't know. I mean, Charlie, all this is so late breaking that I have not had time to brush up on
what is clear though is that this trade war is escalating, and you know what's interesting is that earlier this week, as the economic anxieties began to, you know, bubble up, and clearly there were reports that the Donald Trump had a high level of anxiety about this, as frankly, you know, he ought to, because of course a wobbly economy would be an existential threat to his reelection, right? I mean, it's Even though the economy has been strong, it's not enough to get his ratings up. But a weak economy would absolutely be fatal for his reelection. So he's nervous about it. They're throwing out ideas. He's obsessively pressuring the Fed to drop the interest rates by 100 basis points. He acknowledges they're floating out the idea of a payroll tax, all the stimulus, all of those things. And I'm guessing that somebody must have whispered in his ear or told him at some point that the most important thing that he needed to do was to end this trade war with China, to come to a deal, strike a deal with China to reassure the market. So there was certainly the possibility that the president might take his foot off the accelerator a little bit, or his finger off the trigger, whichever metaphor you feel like on a Friday afternoon. And that clearly is not happening. And so, you know, all of the uncertainty back on the table, who knows what the next front's going to be. This thing is not going to end anytime soon.
We've seen so far, you know, the narrative that the Trump campaign is trying to put out, the Trump 2020 campaign, I should say, for the transition to this next cycle, is that we have a presidency that's gliding very smoothly forward with a strong economy and all this deregulation and unemployment being low and things like that, and just sort of this seamless transition from make America great again to keep America great. It's almost this like mission accomplished flavor. But even, you know, through this whole period of time where things have been going relatively relatively well on the most important issues for Trump's reelection. It's not like he's been, you know, very calm and sort of collected for the last, you know, 2 years, right? I mean, it's always been, you know, one fire after another, one little outburst after another. And now I think the only thing that's different that we're seeing is that he is starting to feel pressure on those, not only on all the things that sort of occupy his lizard brain, all the little Fox News controversies and dust ups with the left and things like this, but actually things that are striking at sort of the central message that he needs for his reelection. And it's not going well. I mean, I think we can all say that it's not looking like he's handling it incredibly
okay,
well.
Okay, well, he just tweeted out that he hereby orders the stock market to go up today.
Is that true?
No, of course not.
But It could be true.
See, there was a moment where you go, oh no, could he possibly do that? Because I mean, we're in this era where can you make it up anymore? So I among the things that get lost in the shuffle here is this attack on Jay Powell, the head of the Fed, where he says, who's a greater enemy? I mean, to could talk about his, you know, an American government official, his own appointee, and comparing him to the authoritarian leader of China, which is breathtaking in itself. But here you have the president who is making no secret of the fact that he is browbeating and bullying the Fed. So much for Fed independence, Sarah Longwell.
Yeah, and this is strategically stupid on his part, because the same way that the trade war is backfiring, the more outward political pressure he puts on the Fed, the less likely they are, I hope, to capitulate. Because if they do go in lower interest rates, even if they think it's the right thing to do, they know there's nothing more important than maintaining their independence. You saw all the former Fed chairs come out in a Wall Street Journal op-ed, it was like 2 weeks ago maybe, all really stressing the need for political independence for the bank. And so I think it's going to end up working against him.
I think that's a great point. I mean, because he's really put them in a no-win situation right now. Even if they decided this was a prudent step to do to counter the negative impacts of the trade war, they would be surrendering the appearance of independence, which has consequences in and of itself.
And they'd be surrendering him at a moment when the president politically is at the weakest maybe he's ever been, which I just think from a calculation standpoint that they would be loath to do. You know, he's coming off. This is just going thinking about the trade war, the Fed and all of this stuff. We're at this moment, like not accidentally. It's been about 3 weeks, I think, since this started with the go back to where you came from tweets, which translated into the send her back chants, which then rolled into the Elijah Cummings attacks on Baltimore, which found its zenith in sort of laughing over the fact that his house had been robbed, which then moved into the weekend of shootings and the one in El Paso being politically motivated and to some degree, I think, incited by some of the president's rhetoric. And then you saw the markets dropping. We had a really wild ride last week. Which led to going into the weekend of last week the first polls really coming out since all of those things happened. And you had that Fox News poll that showed him not being able to break 40% head to head against any one of his potential competitors from the Democratic side. And I think that is causing a total unraveling right now. And the only thing that he's had going for him is this economy. But for this economy, he'd never be hanging out at that 42% number. And so you're right that it's an existential threat. But that's why it's so weird. Again, this is another tactical mistake I think he's making. You start ordering private companies to do something, he needs the support of private companies right now. Like, those are the people who've kind of been hanging in with him because they see him as preferable to potentially a Democrat. But they'll abandon him over stuff like this. I mean, he's going through some kind of a break with reality, seems like.
Yeah, he is. And it does have that feeling. And there's, you know, even before today, there was all of these op-ed pieces talking about the president melting down, Eugene Robinson, Rick Wilson talking about, you know, the president basically being crazy. I wrote a piece. I wrote a piece yesterday for the Bulwark, basically saying there's no method to the madness here. There's no rational tactical explanation for his you know wallowing in anti-Semitic tropes. There's no rational political upside to retweeting conspiracy theorists who you know talk about him being the second coming of God. I mean, so this is somebody. He's just there. Does seem to be something that is broken. Now, maybe you know. Again, I get the point that we've had the crazy for the last 2 years. This is nothing new, but the last several days just feels like he's unhinged in a kind of, in a particularly panicked kind of way. At a time when he ought to be at his most disciplined, and I think you know, going back to your point, Sarah, is you know, if in fact he understands that it is for him really crucial to get the economy right, none of the stuff that he's doing seems to be tracking with that. If he understands the problem of losing these swing voters and watching the hemorrhaging among key constituents, he's not doing anything to get them back.
Yeah, I think that's right. He's, you know, I do think this is just, I am not a psychologist, and I don't know, but I do think a lot of it has to do with the polling. He started tweeting out today amidst all this other stuff. Like he had one that said 94% of support from Republicans. Thank you. And it's weird because I was just like, what is the source for that? Like he doesn't have like
he just made it up.
Man. Who said that? Because there was a poll that came out yesterday from Monmouth that is the worst showing he's ever had. He's at I believe 38% overall, but his support among Republicans has dropped to 79%. His support among independents was at 40%. Democrats was at, not shockingly, 4%. And that Fox News poll too, you know, he goes out and accuses Fox News and says, they've never been good to me. Their polling arm, they're terrible. What's going on in Fox News? The fact is, Fox News actually has like a very solid polling arm. They're sort of the gold standard on polling. And so I think that has a lot to do with his unraveling, because the idea of him losing even some of that core support. I mean, there's got to be people coming to him saying, you might need to get out. Like there might need to just walk off the field.
Let's keep talking about this. But first, let's hear from our sponsor. Look, if you don't know your numbers, you don't know your business. But the problem that growing businesses have that keeps them from knowing their numbers is their hodgepodge of business systems. They have one system for accounting, another one for sales, another one for inventory. It's just a big, inefficient mess, taking up too much time, too many resources, and of course, that hurts the bottom line. So we're introducing NetSuite by Oracle, the business management software that handles aspects of your business in an easy-to-use cloud platform, giving you the visibility and control you need to grow. With NetSuite, you save time, money, and unneeded headaches by, you know, by merging together sales, financing, accounting, orders, and HP instantly, you know, right from your desktop or your phone. That's why NetSuite is the world's number one cloud business system. And right now, NetSuite is offering you valuable insights with a free guide, key strategies to grow your profits. And you can find that at netsuite.com/bulwark. That is netsuite.com/bulwark to download your free guide, these key strategies to grow your profits. netsuite.com/bulwark. Okay, we're back with our megacast panel. So, Sarah, yeah, these numbers are absolutely ghastly for Donald Trump. And, of course, this has stirred up the speculation about whether or not he's vulnerable in a primary. But you saw Chris Cillis's point last night. Did you see this?
Yeah, I did see it.
Okay, so he writes, the never-Trumpers are getting very, very desperate. It speaks to the total takeover of the Republican Party by Donald Trump that the lingering Never Trump movement within the GOP is reduced to trying to pretend they are excited about the idea of Joe Walsh, Mark Sanford, or Bill Weld as their banner carrier in the next year's presidential primary. And he's basically saying, look, you folks, you're scraping the bottom of the barrel here. You know, I mean, Trump is not going to happen. running a serious conservative alternative might have allowed certain elements within the GOP to preserve the idea the whole of the party hadn't capitulated to Trump. That hope is now gone. Is that hope now gone, Sarah?
Well, no, I don't agree with that.
Keep hope alive.
Well, there's a couple things about that letter that I thought were sort of silly. Like, number one is the idea that, like, there's a fielding of a never Trump candidate, that the idea is that the never Trumpers will produce their preferred candidate, which and sometimes people say this to us because obviously we talk a lot about wanting there to be a primary candidate. And they're like, well, you're trying to recruit a primary candidate. You can't recruit somebody to run for president. Like, this is something that people want to do on their own because they have their own reasons for doing it. Now, you can help those things come to fruition, or you can encourage it by pointing things out. So, you know, from our standpoint, one of the things we've always talked about in the hopes that somebody would do it is how soft Trump's support is, how much within the party there's an appetite for an alternative, because it comes up in all of our polling. Now, we've certainly talked to people like, listen, do I wish that Governor Hogan had gotten in the race and said, look, I'm here to present an alternative vision for the future of the Republican Party. This isn't who we have to be. We can have a different future. Do I wish Will Hurd would do that? Do I wish Ben Sasse would do that? Of course I do. But those people aren't doing it. When Mark Sanford and Joe Walsh and Bill Weld all have their own reasons why they wanted to do it. And they're all going to do it in their own way. But they're neither never Trump candidates that have been recruited. That's not a real thing. Nor are they, nor can they serve no strategic purpose, right? Like, it is important to have voices from the right who say things that a lot of the audience on the right may not really have heard. I mean, people don't know. I poll on this all the time and I do these focus groups. They don't know that the debt's gone up more under Trump, over the last 2 years than it did under the last 2 years of President Obama. Like, They hear from Trump all the time that the wall's being built. Well, no, it's not. I mean, the value of having somebody out there truth telling. I mean, Scaramucci's not exact like the most savory character on the planet. But like, is it good that he is out there saying truthful things after being behind the curtain for a while? Is it good that somebody like Joe Walsh is apologizing for the person that he used to be?
And he's got a lot to apologize for.
There's a ton. But the thing is, look, you can't just wave that stuff away with an apology. But I also think that on the other hand, you also can't, like, what do you want people to do, right? What you want every person in this era to do, what I want Trump to do, is to say, I'm sorry that I've been destroying the country with my toxic rhetoric, that I've been calling people, calling President Obama a Muslim, that I launched my entire political that way, which is what Donald Trump did, the person who's now our president. Like, what do I want? I want people to repudiate that and say that they're going to be better going forward. And so I guess it's hard, right? You see the tweets and you think, oh, God. And he was sort of like proto-Trump.
You're talking about Joe Walsh.
Sorry, now I'm talking about Joe Walsh. But Sanford, too. I mean, Sanford, like, his defining thing is the hike that he took when he was cheating on his wife. Yes, it's true. These are imperfect people. I think specifically on the Joe Walsh point, I do think I've been asking myself this question, and I guess I'm not 100% certain on the answer, but I do think on some level, when people say that I was wrong, like, that is what we want people to do, isn't it?
No, we do. And, my response to Chris Saliza saying that never Trumpers are getting very, very desperate is basically to say, you got half a point there. I mean, it is a little bit like coming down from the hills and shooting the wounded after the battle. But but these are desperate times. So desperate times call for desperate measures. So more the merrier. And the key here is the field is together. Will they be able to get enough of a vote to make people, question the inevitability or the viability of Donald Trump? I mean, this is all very quixotic. It's very difficult. And I think the strategic thinking is important here. And all of these three candidates, by the way, appeal to completely different constituencies. You know, Mark Sanford is talking about the debt and the deficit. I'm not sure how many people actually really care about that. you know, Walsh is going to run as a unreconstructed, hardcore conservative Tea Party guy, and he's going to have to answer for a lot of these tweets, which are pretty ghastly. And of course, Bill Weld, represents a much more centrist, moderate point of view. And I agree with you. I mean, I would love to have, a Ben Sasse run or a Larry Hogan run. But I guess one thing I've learned over the last 4 or 5 years is you don't always get what you want, right?
you got Trump campaign song. Yeah.
To be never Trump is to live in disappointment, right?
Yes. We're used to having our souls crushed. And by the way, I interviewed Sanford this morning on Sirius XM, and he basically went out of his way to say that he's not never Trump. He would actually vote for Trump. And quite frankly, should I actually say this on the podcast? I mean, I was really struck by how wimpy he was. It was just like, you're talking about getting into a primary race and you're talking about an issue that's important, but I don't think is actually going to be moving the needle. And then you basically say that you'd vote for Donald Trump over any Democrat. And it's like, saying with one breath, that Donald Trump has not earned a second term, but that you'd still vote for him. It's like, well. Okay, so you're...
Charlie, can I say one thing about this Saliza thing? The thing that struck me about this piece, and his big conclusion right at the end is this. Beating Trump in a primary was never going to happen in 2020, but running a serious conservative alternative might have allowed certain elements within the GOP to preserve the idea that the whole of the party hadn't capitulated to Trump. That hope is now gone. And I think that's, maybe sort of true, like you say, but I also think it really misses the point of, like, what the whole enterprise is. Because the idea of fielding, some never Trump candidate or some anti-Trump candidate, some alternative to Trump candidate, is not just to sort of like be able to convince all the people out there that the Republican Party of 2020 isn't that bad, right? I mean, like, look around, there's a lot of bad stuff going on. Nobody's trying to deny how bad things are, I think, in our camp, or how wacky things have gotten. It's just that we sort of look around and see that this thing can only hold up, the weight of its own contradictions and absurdities for so long, right? It's going to collapse. There's going to be some sort of, fissure that opens up, and something is going to need to be done to pick up the pieces if there's going to be any kind of, right-leaning, fiscally conservative, socially conservative, just conservative at all, force in American politics once all of this stuff, goes absolutely to shit, right? So it's less about, just trying to, say peace when there is no peace, and it's more that it's more forward looking than that. It's like right. At some point we're going to need to get the ball rolling. Might as well start now. It might be starting small now, but it's any kind of momentum forward is not to be spurned at this moment, I feel like.
Well, and also what else are some of us going to do? I mean, from my point of view, was there any alternative? If Donald Trump is fundamentally unfit, if he is offensive to every decent value that you hold, what are we supposed to do? What is the answer? We're not going to all become socialists necessarily. We're not all going to become Democrats, and you fight for it and you fight with what you have. And it has been frustrating and it has been disappointing. I will tell you, Sarah, when I say that I'm wrestling, I'm wrestling. There's a small list of issues that I am really squishy on. I try not to be squishy. It's not my goal in life to be squishy. In fact, it's my goal in life not to be squishy. But I am squishy on a number of issues. And one of them is this whole question of the enemy of my enemy is my friend type thing. And you wrote a really good piece, really thoughtful piece that I've read several times about, Anthony Scaramucci. And basically, like, okay, we can't have this standard of ideological purity. If somebody's going to come over to our side at this moment, we need to welcome them. And I really appreciate that point of view. I really do. On the other hand, I do have this sort of gut sense, like, we've done this before and it didn't work out so well for us. You know what I'm saying? It's like there's leave it out to the Trump issue. I mean, think about the conservative movement, all the allies we made because, well, I'm going to align myself with these guys because they're also enemies of the left. So let's just, make friends with everybody. And as a result, we made alliances with a lot of really unsavory characters, and that's come back to bite us. So there is that danger that we're experiencing, are we supposed to embrace the Omarosas, the Scaramucci's, the other folks that may have these very sketchy both backgrounds and characters? And doesn't that sort of get us, you know, isn't that what got us here? Do you follow where I'm going, why I'm squishing?
I do follow it. I'll just say one thing. I didn't write that piece. Rachel Larimore did. But I will stand for that piece because I think I agree with it.
I'm sorry. You did. Yeah. I don't know.
It was a really thoughtful piece. And I'll be honest, I was writing something similar when then her piece popped and I was like, oh, well, Rachel made the case well. But I think the question is not about embracing so much as it is, you know, how do you align incentives? And it goes back to the sort of, it's the same thing as the Walsh piece to some degree, is if you don't make room, right, for people to repudiate the things that they've said, then what is their incentive for ever walking away from Trump? And I think that the question is the difference between embrace and like allowance, because I think you have to allow people like Scaramucci, who says, and I think it's totally fine to doubt the purity of his intentions in his case. But I think you have to sort of allow him to do it because there's no doubt what he's saying is true, right? So like the same, it's also the idea that things are true even if somebody you don't like is saying it. Like they are just objectively true what he's saying about Trump. And so I think that it's okay. Like we should be in a place where we can say, yep, that is a true thing that he's saying. And it's good that he's saying it. And he should to some degree be like rewarded isn't quite the right word, but we should say like, this is a good thing. At the same time, I don't think that anybody has to link arms and say, now we are like, this is my army. You know, and this is the thing, like they're just going back really quickly to the idea of having a never Trump candidate. There's not going to be a never Trump candidate. That's not a thing. I like find the whole premise of Cizilla's piece to be specious and ridiculous. Like, who's the idea? Like me being never Trump, what I really want is for somebody responsible to beat Donald Trump, right? And so I have all kinds of issues, and this just goes back to your conversation about purity. I have all kinds of issues with the way that Nikki Haley has put her arms around the diamond and silks and sort of kowtows to the Charlie Kirks. I hate that. And it diminishes her in my eyes. That being said, I'm desperate for her to run. Jim Mattis, who I have nothing negative to say about, but did go, I think, as a patriot and work within the administration. If he were to run, I don't consider him never Trump. The guy worked in the administration. We're not looking for a negative Trump candidate. We're just looking for somebody responsible, because the idea, this is the one thing that I believe in more, maybe more than anything else. Well, I believe in lots of things, but the idea that you need a responsible Republican governing party, that you can't just have the left. You need a Republican party that is responsible, not just to rein in the excesses of the left, but because you need two major political parties in the country, at least two major political parties. It is very bad if there is just one. And so it's the right fight to try to do something to stabilize it.
No, you're right about all of that. And again, this whole alliances that you make, though, is it's hard. I'm sitting here in my study doing this podcast, and I'm looking at a picture I have on the wall because it reminds me of things, of me standing there with Ted Cruz. And I'm talking to Ted Cruz, and I'm probably saying something like, we will do anything we can to get you to, you know, have you beat Trump here in Wisconsin, which we did. But I was not a Ted Cruz fan. Ted Cruz, and certainly, you know, Ted Cruz has exposed himself, who he is and what he's all about, rather dramatically, since then. But that was one of those enemy of my enemies is my friend's moment. And I'm sort of surrounded by the ghosts of bad alliances, if you know what I mean. And I think a lot of us are. And so I guess that's why I do think there's notes of caution in investing in any of these alternatives, whether it's Scaramucci or Joe Walsh or Mark Sanford or any of these other folks out there. You want people to come over and acknowledge that they've made mistakes. We could use all the allies we could get, but I guess, going forward, put not your faith in princes or temporary friends.
Yeah, we just have the bulwark, guys. Just the bulwark.
It's just us. I'm willing to trust Egger I'm all in on Edgar. I mean, I will support Edgar like 65% of the time. So anybody want to talk about David Koch or the legacy of the Koch brothers? David Koch passing away at the age of 79, and of course, he's been the boogeyman for the left for so long. And of course, there's the usual tasteless dancing on his grave. I guess the one thing I want to say is that in the last couple of years, I've had a mixed relationship with the Koch network and everything, but I've come to appreciate the fact that they actually cared about ideas. Some of the ideas were wrong, but they cared about ideas the way that some of their successor, should we say, billionaire oligarchs on the right haven't. And people need to remember that David Koch fought for lots of things, you know, for civil liberties, you know, for reducing economic restrictions on lower income people, you know, the reform of licensing. He was a supporter of gay rights. He was a supporter of criminal justice reform. And so his legacy is much more complicated than I think a lot of people have acknowledged in the past. And I think that they rather sincerely were pushing for policies that they believed in, that they thought would make this a better society and a better culture. And they were not always right. And I think they got some things pretty seriously wrong. But if you're going to contrast them with their successors, and I'm thinking of like the Mercers, who decided to go all in on Breitbart and go all in on Steve Bannon and everything, the Kochs represented, you know, something important. And I just, the last point is that Trumpism is really the antithesis of many of the things that the Koch brothers fought for. It represents a rejection. And if there is going to be ever a restoration of principled conservatism, they will play a role because they have kept some distance with Trump. They have not gone all in, and I think they deserve some credit for that.
I just have two things to say probably about David Koch. And the one is that, I mean, I am less familiar. The Koch era, I feel like, is almost a relic, you know, from a previous version of America back when they were sort of like the big bad boys of the right and all that stuff. But you know, as far as me and a lot of people, you know, my age and a little older are concerned, the big legacy of the Koch brothers is that they built this, you know, really powerful infrastructure for, you know, getting young people involved in conservative politics and Republican politics and things like that. And just sort of, you know, that enabled a lot of people who might not otherwise have ever really been interested in politics, or certainly not sort of thinking of it as a thing they would, you know, do with their careers, sort of just giving them resources, giving them opportunities and things like that. And I think, we're sort of a force for good in that way. And maybe the great irony of that is that a lot of those same pipelines have now been sort of co-opted. A lot of, you know, youth Republicanism now, whether it's, you know, College Republicans or Turning Point USA or Young Americans for Liberty, all these groups, you know, it's become a much more sort of like trigger the libs type feeling, which I can't imagine the Koch brothers themselves were incredibly happy about. But you know, you have to, you know, admire the infrastructure that they built and all that stuff. And then the other thing is that it's maybe kind of funny or something or appropriate that David Koch got to go out on a note where, you know, just as the left had suddenly become a little confused, you know, like, oh man, I thought this guy was one of the great villains of the American right. And now he's like a resistance figure and what's going on. And before they could really figure all that out, he just sort of, you know, exits stage right. And they don't know how to be mad exactly, which I feel is what I thought that was kind of nice personally.
Yeah. I think the legacy is going to end up being a lot more complicated than people think. Cause I don't know how much you guys have been paying much attention to this, but they are shifting who they are in this moment in a very specific way. I mean, they are no longer committed in a partisan way to the Republican Party, and they are changing a great deal of their institutional focus to how you empower individuals. And that is everything from criminal justice reform to some economic justice type things. But their role as an exclusive force on the right is, I think their new group is called Stand Together. And I think, Charlie, I just want to really agree with what you said in terms of who they are. I mean, my experience sort of coming up, I think I came up in just the generation before Edgar, and they were a tremendous intellectual force. And yeah, they weren't right about everything, but they were right on a ton of stuff. And I'll say, if the Kochs had had it their way, Trump would have never happened, because one of their biggest focuses has been on immigration and been on having a more inclusive legal immigration structure. And it is the opposite of that instinct that has driven Trump and has become a driving force in the Republican Party, which they totally eschewed and were against. And so I think that a lot of times people have this really ridiculous Jane Mayer caricature of the Kochs. But they were, in my opinion, a net force for good. And I think in just about any case, regardless of political affiliation, when people do this good riddance type thing after the death of someone, I think that is the worst of us.
It is the worst of us. It's one of the most depressing things on social media. And I suppose there is sort of a symbolic significance that David Koch, who was always for free markets, goes out on a day in which we're almost living through this cartoon satire on what it would be like to have somebody who just disdains, free markets. That didn't put that well. But I mean, when the President of the United States, going back to where we started, issuing orders to American companies what investment decisions they should make, it's like, wow, it is really remarkable. I think it was Tom Nichols who said that the president has gone all night at Camp David today. Do you know the reference to that? I actually enjoy that. It's like a 1960, I think maybe a 1965 novel about a president of the United States who basically goes insane. And it just recently was sort of revived and became more popular and everything. But you almost need to go back to these fictional accounts to capture what we have. By the way, for people listening to the podcast, if you go to the Bulwark website, Andrew Eggers' piece is up. Trump tweets, the markets tank. This is totally normal. Everything is fine, just fine. Really? I like your line about all of the airing of Twitter grievances in the past. Yet none of these previous festivi match Friday's eruption for sheer old man yells at cloud, impotent frustration. One might also almost begin to suspect the trade war isn't going super great. Really? They were supposed to be so. And you know what? What we haven't talked about, given an indication of how crazy this week is, we're not talking about on the megacast, we're not talking about Greenland yet. I mean, we could go on for another 3 hours.
Oh, I meant to include that as like his because he does this, right? Whenever things are going badly, he throws chum in the water to distract, which we're all happy to oblige. And like, that was like the one, because he had that sort of charming tweet where he made fun of himself.
Yes, yes.
By tweeting the Trump Tower and grab won't do this to Greenland. But that is maybe that's a positive sign that despite the fact that it ended up turning into like a real thing that maybe we were going to do that could have been like an international incident, it's past.
No, it's not. Nothing is ever past. See, this is Donald Trump can't decide whether it's a joke or not. And that was it seemed like a little bit reassuring for like 5 minutes when he tweeted out the thing about Trump Tower. But then he cancels a state visit to Denmark on the eve of the G7 summit. How's that going to go, by the way? I mean, that's going to be you think that we can't have more international embarrassments?
Denmark's out, but Russia's in.
Well, I wrote a piece about this. This is the other thing I have a new piece up just this morning. Of what you see over and over again in these situations is how all of Trump's apologists and fanboys and everything like to talk about how one of his great strengths is how he's sort of impervious to the media, and he doesn't take his cues from them, and he doesn't kowtow and bow when they say bow and things like that. But I think what we see in stories like this over and over again is how reactive to media he is, how he is sort of enslaved to the media cycle in just sort of like a mirror image version, where when it was just sort of like a story people were like riffing on and having a fun time with, he was able to sort of like just sort of be jokey about it. But then when people really knuckled down and started talking about this is a good idea, this is a bad idea, Trump's really dumb for proposing this, no, Trump's really smart for proposing this, that's when he like flips that switch in his brain, be like, oh no, I have to really go for this now. And so he provokes this whole international incident with the prime minister of Denmark. And it's a weird thing to see.
Well, and I mean, as you pointed out, it's not just a silly sideshow. It does indicate how he has been conducting foreign policy in this country. I don't know who it was who said, it took 70 years to develop this 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 the foreign policy infrastructure, and it's taken Donald Trump 3 years to dismantle it. I mean, how depressing is all of that? Also, though, you saw that Tom Cotton from Arkansas is now saying this is not just some crazy idea. This was my idea. I came up with this idea. I actually suggested it to the Danish prime minister. And it's like, oh, man, I'm old enough to remember when Tom Cotton was like a serious guy.
Well, but no, it isn't necessarily a bad idea, you know, just as an absolute. Like, would it be a good thing for the U.S. to own Greenland? Like, maybe it would be. I don't know. It's strategically useful. We have a lot of military bases there. I don't know. But
50,000 people there.
Yeah, but it's beside the point, right? I mean, the question of whether or not, you know, it would be strategically good for us to own Greenland is a completely separate question from, you know, is it a good idea for Donald Trump to provoke an international incident because Denmark won't sell us Greenland, right? I mean, we should be able to have at least the conversation on two different planes, right?
I'm more and more convinced that if Donald Trump loses for re-election, it won't be because people are outraged. It will be because people are exhausted. I mean, I'm just exhausted by the guy.
I'm exhausted too, Charlie.
I'm just exhausted. But see, this is why it's good, because it's Friday.
At least it's Friday.
Yes.
And nothing ever happens over the weekends. He doesn't tweet or anything, so that's always nice.
Yeah, hopefully, you know, for the cause of world peace, the weather is good enough that he can be out and golfing all day. I mean, yeah. that really is the best case scenario.
Totally.
Hey, well, thank you for spending time on a Friday today talking about all of the crazy, Sarah Longwell and Andrew Egger. We'll have to see how this all turns out, right?
It'll be a blast.
We'll see.
And thank you for listening to the Bulwark Podcast. Today's episode was brought to you by NetSuite. I'm Charlie Sykes. We'll be back on Monday, and we'll do this all over again.